Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate starts debate today on an $11 billion energy bill, with a tough debate expected on two key issues, offshore drilling and greenhouse gases. Some Republicans breaking ranks with the White House on emissions controls. And there's another battle looming down the road with the House, which has already passed its own bill, including a controversial provision for drilling in Alaska's Anwar Wildlife Preserve, making it hard to see how the two houses can reconcile their differences and hand President Bush a bill to sign this summer, as he's requested. Well, joining us with an overview is Shannon Davis. She's editor of the newsletter EnergyWashington.com. Shannon, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And to the Senate bill, the key provisions of the bill seem to be to reduce dependence on foreign oil, and there seems to be a good deal of bipartisan support for most of those provisions. But there are a couple of issues to get by. The first, new measures on greenhouse gases. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, it's actually quite interesting that they're bringing climate change, the climate change debate, into the energy bill debate. This is definitely a major shift in the past, and the fact that they're going to have some serious debate over this issue is actually a first of its kind.
And Republican senators, including John McCain, offering some solutions.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We actually have most of all the provisions definitely have some Republican support. Senator McCain and Lieberman, they've had a bill for the past 2 years now. They have two versions of the same bill that will be that may or may not come up on the floor, both or one. And basically the first one would be a cap and trade. It would cap greenhouse gases, specifically carbon dioxide, and would allow utilities to trade those credits. And this would be a mandatory cap, and the utility industry hates it, the Bush administration hates it, and no one knows how it's going to play out if it comes to a vote.
This is the same process that they have in Europe that McCain is suggesting. The White House said, and President Bush said as recently as this week in the press conference with Britain's Tony Blair, that more information is needed before President Bush can take steps on global warming. So this is obviously a breaking of ranks.
Exactly. I mean, you have Congress saying, we know climate change is happening. We believe humans have a role in this climate, in this change in the global temperature, and we want to figure out how to deal with it. The White House is still sticking to the science is not in. We're not certain exactly what role power plants and emission and human emissions are playing. So we still need more information. So it's a major shift.
Well, the next big battle is expected over offshore drilling. Louisiana wants it. Florida does not. In fact, a Florida Democratic senator has said he'll block the bill if it comes into play. So tell us more about the issue there.
Well, I mean, actually, Senator Nelson from Florida is on the floor of the Senate as we speak, talking about his opposition to lifting off a ban on offshore drilling. And you definitely have a few states, including Louisiana, that would like to get access to some of the moratoria spots on their outer continental shelf, and they'd like to drill and get a bigger piece of the revenue pie to help their states. And Florida, California, Maine, New Jersey are dead set against it. They don't want drilling. They don't want a ban lifted. And Nelson, along with Senator Martinez, also from Florida, they're engaging the White House. There's been a ban for two decades, and they don't want any language that would make it possible at any time in the near future to lift that ban. They don't want drilling off their coast.
Well, looking down the road, the Senate, which is debating their bill, is balking at a provision in the House bill, which was already passed. It's protection against liability for oil companies who use the contaminating additive MTBE. MTBE, that's the anti-knock gasoline additive that replaced lead in the late 70s. It's been proven to seep into and contaminate water supplies. Minority Leader Harry Reid says if MTBE makers are not held liable in an eventual energy bill, there will be no bill. So in the few seconds we have, where do you think that's going to go? Oh, well, she's going to go. Oh, Shannon Davis, editor of EnergyWashington.com. Obviously, something happened with her phone line. We'll try to get her back at a later date, but we will let you know that the discussion over MTBE, the additive, is certain to be on the minds of everyone trying to fashion an energy bill. The energy bill debate, as she said, is going on this week. There was the hope on the part of the majority side, the Republican side, that the bill would be passed by the end of the week. But there are doubts on the parts of many watchers, including Shannon Davis of EnergyWashington.com. It's well known that Russian President Vladimir Putin is a former KGB agent and a devotee of martial arts. But a new book argues that Putin was the hand-picked successor of Russian reformer Boris Yeltsin, who taught him how to dress, walk, and talk like a president. And once in the Kremlin, Putin turned his back on the people who put him there. Instead of continuing reform, he further consolidated power. Washington Post reporters Peter Baker and Susan Glasser, who are also husband and wife, were Moscow bureau chiefs for the newspaper, and they have the bead on Putin in their new book, Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. They talked with dozens of Russian political figures, including some Putin aides who rarely speak with Western journalists. And Peter and Susan speak to us now from a radio studio at the Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, about Project Putin. Susan, what was that?
Well, Project Putin was really the secret effort to install a little-known and completely obscure KGB agent named Vladimir Putin into the Kremlin back in 1999 as Boris Yeltsin's successor. This was the name that Yeltsin's coterie of advisors and family members gave to their own project. They called it Project Putin. The guy started out at 2% in the polls through the skillful manipulation of television and other administrative levers of power. In effect, they convinced the Russian people that Vladimir Putin was the indispensable man. And in the space of a few short months, Putin was the leader of the Kremlin.
And the players behind the scene, Putin and his crowd of former KGB men, the Siloviki, am I saying that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Siloviki,
or men of power. Yeltsin's clique was called the Family. What did the Family see in Putin? Why did they pick him originally?
Well, they really thought he was going to be loyal. They knew that Putin had been an aide to the mayor of St. Petersburg and helped him out when he was in trouble with prosecutors. And they were worried about what would happen when Yeltsin gave up power. Would their enemies come after them, try to prosecute them, take retribution against them? They wanted the guy who took over for Yeltsin to be an absolute loyalist. In that, they were right. Putin has always been loyal to Yeltsin in the sense that he has kept Yeltsin and his people safe. But they were wrong when they thought he could be controlled. Project Putin turned out to be a much more independent thing than they realized and really got away from its original authors.
And as you write, the former spy became acting president on New Year's Eve 1999. He was formally elected 3 months later. A few months after that election, he gave a closed-door speech at the old KGB headquarters. He said something so astonishing, people in the audience, the civilians in the audience, thought it was a joke. The generals in the audience apparently didn't. What did he say, and what did you take that he meant by it?
Well, this was really an incredible moment. Putin was meeting with a secret group of several hundred generals of the former KGB on a Stalin-era holiday called the Day of the Czechist, the Day of the Secret Service Man. And he got up in front of this audience of KGB generals and he said, "Instruction number one for obtaining full power has been completed." And the civilians in the hall joked, but many years later, they came to realize that perhaps it wasn't a joke after all, that this was actually, you know, part of a plan.
Instruction number one for obtaining full power has been completed. I mean, would somebody seriously, even with translation, would somebody seriously say that? It sounds like a robot speaking.
Yes, well, that's Putin is a very stiff fella for one thing, but that's the way these KGB veterans talked. They talked in terms of the Secret Service they had grown up with, and you know he got up there and they knew what he meant. They knew that 10 years after the fall of communism, after the fall of the Soviet Union, one of their own was in power in the Kremlin. It was a very meaningful moment, though none of us was able to see it at the time.
Well, it also opens up the question: what are instructions number 2, 3, and 4?
That's right.
Well, presumably, we've seen instructions 2, 3, and 4 in the way that Putin has gone about consolidating his power over the last several years, whether it's taking over television or canceling gubernatorial elections, which is what he did last year. I think you can see the hallmarks of a very methodical and often thought-through campaign to eliminate potential sources of political rivalry.
Let's talk about television with that, because it plays a huge role. As you write, he's obsessed with television. He brings home videos of the newscasts to see how he was covered.
Yes, exactly. And then he comes in the Kremlin the next day and he starts telling his aides, he didn't like this or he liked that and so forth. And so, you know, one of the very first things he did within a year or so of coming into office was to drive the two moguls who ran the two most important television stations in Russia out of the country and to take over the only independent network that existed at that time. You know, then they had these meetings on Friday afternoons where the Kremlin would actually get together the leaders, the managers of television, and then go through them the week's agenda, what they could cover and what they couldn't cover.
And this brings us to the topic of oligarchs, because as the Soviet Union fell, several Russians rose who took over became different captains of industry throughout the country. And Putin seemed to go about taking that power away from them, beginning with television.
Well, he took away power from some oligarchs. He took away power from oligarchs he felt were a threat to him. We just saw the guilty verdict and sentencing of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was Russia's richest man and a big-time oil tycoon, because most people believe because Khodorkovsky was a rival power center to Putin. But there's a whole lot of oligarchs who demonstrate their loyalty to Putin, who don't give him any trouble. They're allowed to do anything they want, and there's a whole new class of oligarchs who've risen in the last 5 years under Putin, in many ways benefiting from the actions of the state as controlled by Putin's Kremlin.
Well, we've seen the pictures of Khodorkovsky standing in a sort of behind a cage in his trial. One of our NPR reporters said he was arrested and jailed partly because he broke a pact with Putin and the other oligarchs about not challenging Putin.
Well, that's exactly right. When Putin came into office, he understood probably better than most people the power that the oligarchs had obtained over Yeltsin's Kremlin. And these very same people were the people who helped install him as president in Project Putin. But he was determined to break their hold over the Kremlin. And at the very beginning of his presidency, he called the oligarchs in to a meeting at the Kremlin, and he said, there's a new deal from now on. I will let you maintain your money, your business power, and the difference is you will not exert political control anymore in the way that you did in the 1990s. And the oligarchs said, yes, yes, okay. And Khodorkovsky, according to Putin's aides in the Kremlin, broke that pact. And I think that's the source of the very personal animus that seemed to develop between President Putin and Khodorkovsky.
That's Susan Glasser. She and Peter Baker are staff writers for The Washington Post. They were also co-bureau chiefs in Moscow for the paper, and their husband and wife. And together they've written a new book entitled Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. When we come back, is Putin's Russia returning to the ways of the old Soviet Union? Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about Russia under President Vladimir Putin with husband and wife team Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. Peter and Susan are Washington Post reporters. They were the newspaper's Moscow bureau chiefs. Together, they've written a new book entitled Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. And Peter, you were just telling us about how Boris Yeltsin and his clique put Vladimir Putin in power, but Putin then turned his back on them and further consolidated his power, in part by taking control of the Russian media. So what are you saying? Is Putin the new czar? Is Russia returning to the old days of the Soviet Union?
Well, look, it's not the Soviet Union all over again. It's not like people in everyday life worry that if they tell a joke that makes fun of Putin that their neighbors are going to rat them out and they'll be sent to the gulag. That's not happening. But it is sort of neo-Soviet in some of the techniques and some of the general mentality. And what it means is that that there are no segments in society that can genuinely exert any power or influence. Let me give you an example. What if the President of the United States took over CNN, Fox, MSNBC, NBC, CBS, you know, ABC. What if the president was in charge of all of those networks? What if, in fact, the president had only his own party having any power whatsoever in the Congress? There was no filibuster, let's say that. And what if the president of the United States appointed the governor of New York, the governor of Massachusetts, the governor of Texas and California? That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Well, what is your take then on Putin, the man? Because we see him as cool and collected, the former spy. You portray him obsessively watching television news reports about himself on videotape at night, you know, a little sweatier.
Well, I think to a certain extent, there's some of the veil is off. I mean, both Peter and I have interviewed President Putin several times in group situations with other American correspondents in Moscow. And in fact, the demeanor that he projected in those situations was, as you described, very cool, calm, collected. He's excellent at memorizing his briefing book. He can spew long, long paragraphs of facts and details, information about nuclear warheads and throw weights and that sort of thing. But even in those situations, we saw several times where the veil was pierced. And if you asked him, for example, about Chechnya and the Russians' conduct of the war in Chechnya and human rights violations, he would get very angry. His entire face and demeanor would change. And many times he would make the few gaffes of his presidency when challenged by a reporter on a subject like that. And I think our reporting found even more examples of that in private situations where that we haven't been able to see up to this point.
Well, in fact, you write about a day in the winter of 2004 when Putin abruptly fired his prime minister, and that's sort of symbolic of this. Tell us why.
Well, that was really the triumph of paranoia over a Kremlin that had already basically eliminated genuine competition as President Putin was heading to his own reelection. But they began to worry that the election would be so boring because there was no real opposition that they wouldn't have enough people turn out to make it a legitimate election under Russian law and that they'd have to have a whole new vote.
Because by law, if they didn't get a certain percentage of people the prime minister would become president for a month.
The prime minister would have a month in which he would be president. And even though Putin had appointed him prime minister, he began to worry that this guy would do to him what Putin had done to everybody else and that suddenly Putin would find himself on the outs. And so he fired the prime minister and put it in somebody else who was viewed as even more loyal. So it really shows that how President Putin thinks, and he is absolutely determined to control every bit of what they call managed democracy. One aide told us, quote, in his mentality, every risk should be minimized to zero.
Well, and another aide told you, actually not even an aide, another former KGB member told you that there's so many former KGB members now in the halls of power, we are like some kind of demigods doing something that will either save Russia or badly damage it.
Yes.
Which do you think will be the outcome?
Well, predicting the future in Russia is a very dangerous business, and it certainly has been since 1917. In fact, one of our colleagues in the bureau in Moscow used to joke with us. Every day we complained about there not being a news story, she would say, well, Susan, you know, every day that there's no news is a good day for Russia. And the truth is that most days there are big news stories that come out of Russia. So we're not in the prediction business, but I think that you know, Putin's goal has been to head off the sort of street revolution that you've seen elsewhere on the periphery of Russia in the last year or so, in Georgia, in Ukraine, even in Kyrgyzstan and Central Asia. And I think the question is whether that pressure from non-existent civil society institutions, from the lack of accountability in the new system in Russia, whether there's pressure that builds up against that and whether Putin and his aides are prepared to deal with the outcome of that.
And Peter, I just want to ask you, we started by talking about how President Putin had been created, an image that was created, an extraordinarily popular one. Is he still?
Well, he is. Yeah, he is. And but, you know, again, that's a function of a society in which basically there are no alternatives ever presented to the public. When, for instance, last fall, the Chechen terrorists took over that school in Beslan and slaughtered those school children. Yeah, that could be a nightmare beyond the actual tragedy for any politician leading a country. But Putin made sure that he suffered no fallout from that. The television didn't even show the hostage crisis when it first began blowing up. Instead, they kept showing soap operas. And when they did talk about it, Putin was portrayed as a man of conviction and strength, while the government, in fact, was actually lying to its own people about what had really happened.
Well, and again, Susan, is democracy because of everything you've been talking about, over in Russia? Is this going to be the form of democracy we see in Russia? Did democracy ever really exist in Russia?
Wow, these are all great and provocative questions, and I think it reminds me actually of a joke that Grigory Yavlinsky, who was one of the sort of dwindling band of Democrats in Russia, made last year to a conference. He was asked that same question, what's the state of Russian democracy? And he told an old Soviet-era joke, he said, about an ambulance driver who was taking a man to the morgue instead of to the hospital. And the man sat up and he said, excuse me, why are you taking me to the morgue? I'm not dead yet. And the ambulance driver turned around, looked at him and said, well, we're not there yet. So who knows, right?
Susan and Peter, thank you both. Susan Glasser and Peter Baker, staff writers for The Washington Post. Their new book is entitled Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Economists say a robust housing market is hiding some troubling trends. Lenders, faced with an increasing demand for mortgages, are offering loans that lead borrowers into greater risk. The number of owners borrowing against their homes is up dramatically. And the rise in home prices is increasingly fueled by investment buyers, people hoping to turn around a house for a profit. Well, lenders are defending themselves, saying these trends are appropriate and responsible reactions to a strong housing market. Here Now's Martha Biebinger looks at how this national dynamic is playing out in the hot housing market in and around Boston.
What's up, Henry?
Yeah,
go for a run.
Where else do you find green space like this? This is incredible.
Linnea Litz and Ryan McQuaid watch Henry, their black greyhound, bound across half an acre of green lawn behind the Dorchester condo complex where they bought a unit last month. Litz and McQuaid borrowed the total cost of the condo, $298,000. 100% financing can be risky. If the value of the home drops, buyers may owe more than the amount they borrowed. But for Litz, who just finished graduate school, and McQuaid, who finished a PhD in biology last year, the no-money-down option was the only way they could afford to buy.
We expect, or we hope, that it's going to increase in value over the time that we're here. And we feel like we got a great deal on the mortgage and a good deal on the condo. And we're hopeful.
I think we've really purchased in the right neighborhood, and our value will go up. I feel pretty confident about that.
It's not like the old days. Today, the rules have changed dramatically.
Fred Breimeyer, president of the New England Economic Partnership, says buying a house without any money down is just one example of how mortgage lending rules have become more flexible to help prospective owners, particularly in markets like Greater Boston. There are now 40-year mortgages, interest-only loans, even plans where homeowners pay just part of the interest. The portion of income on which monthly payments are based is up from 25% to as high as 50%, and poor credit records are no longer a barrier. The joke among lenders in one office these days is, if you're not dead yet, you can get a mortgage. Director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University, Nicholas Ritsinas, says most of these more flexible mortgages have adjustable rates that will rise with interest rates.
What many new home buyers are looking at is pretty substantial increases in their mortgage payment. And if they were to get salary increases, they'll be fine. But a lot of jobs in this economy don't produce the kind of salary increases that once were the norm. So they may be in trouble in a year or two. Yet people are still taking these adjustable mortgages because they are desperate.
The changes have allowed more people to buy homes. A study out of Harvard's Center for Housing Studies yesterday says the percentage of American households that own a home reached a record 69% in 2004. But Breimeyer says lenders are stretching the rules too far.
There is a very much in the public view a sense that owning a house is a good thing. The question is, are the devices, the lending devices in particular, at this point in time, destabilizing a market that is critically important to Americans? And the answer may be yes.
Lenders counter the market is strong enough to support a higher level of risk. George Ellis is president of Mortgage Advisory Group in Wellesley.
For those people that purchased over the last several years, clearly it was to their advantage to
have done whatever they could to purchase because they now have an asset that's worth more than it was when they purchased it. And to say to any of those people that they shouldn't have used 100% financing in order to purchase it would be a very tough argument.
The rising value of homes has spawned another trend, this one affecting homeowners. Mark Zandi is the chief economist at economy.com.
People have turned their homes into a cash machine, pulling equity out of their homes, and you can do that in a number of ways. The lines of credit have increased almost 50% over the past year. It has grown like a weed over the past several years.
Zandi says homeowners are using the cash for a variety of purposes: home improvements, the purchase of a second home, buying a car, taking a vacation, or financing a child's education. Mortgage lender Ellis says home equity loans are a wise way to borrow because interest rates on home loans are lower than, say, to buy a car, and they are deductible. Ellis says the trend is a sign of a fundamental change in attitudes about home ownership.
People today view the equity in their home as simply another asset to be managed, similar to their stock portfolio or their retirement portfolio, whereas our parents would have been very reluctant to take out a second mortgage, and they would have viewed that as one step away from disaster.
But Zandi says there are reasons to worry.
The near-term concern is that the cash machine gets shut down. If interest rates move higher and the housing market cools, then it, of course, becomes very difficult for homeowners to continue to pull out as much cash. If they can't pull out as much cash, therefore they can't spend as much, and that'll weigh on economic activity and growth. Longer run, it's a problem because households have less equity because they pulled it out. And if house prices start to go south, they may find that they have little to no equity in their home.
There is another development that affects both the homeowner and the individual or couple trying to buy a home.
I had a day off and I had time to think, gee, well, why shouldn't we buy this?
Margie Kern, a part owner at Karp & Lieberman Real Estate Group, stands outside a three-bedroom yellow Cape in Wayland she bought in 2002. A colleague in banking had called to ask if she knew of any interested investors. Kern is using the house as a college savings plan for her 9-year-old daughter.
We had started a college savings plan. We put in $10,000, and then it went up to 11, then it went down to 7. So far I haven't seen any depreciation in the house. In 2002, we paid $305,000 for the house. And right now, I would say probably has a value somewhere in the upper fours, to be conservative.
The National Association of Realtors says 23% of homes sold last year were purchased by investors. Zandi says factoring out vacation home buyers, the individual investor rate is closer to 15%.
And that's up from essentially nothing 3-4 years ago. In the juiced up markets, again in the Northeast, California, Florida, and sundry other places, the investor share is a lot higher and is now rising very quickly.
The rate of speculative buyers, those who buy and sell quickly for a profit, is believed to be much lower, around 3-6%. But any investment purchase reduces the supply of homes and helps push up prices as long as demand is high. Fred Breimeyer and some other economists don't believe housing in the Boston area is a good investment at current prices, but many economists have been saying that for several years. There is debate about how much the current housing market, like the stock market of 4 or 5 years ago, is based on artificial value. Breimeyer says even an inflated housing market is usually more stable than the stock market.
What happens typically in a down market in real estate is the level of activity dries up, far fewer transactions, and prices only grudgingly come down. If you put a heavy load of speculation in, then it becomes a much more rapid decline in prices. And to the extent that that itself is a shock to the market and the people in it, it may cause an even further decline than would be otherwise necessary.
Economists predict that any substantial drop in housing prices, say of 10-20%, would take several years because most homeowners would not sell their homes as soon as they saw the value start to drop. The Harvard Housing Study predicts that demand for homes will reach new records in the next 10 years. That would make it harder to afford a home and increase the pressure to take on a risky mortgage.
That report from Here Now's Martha Biebinger. And still to come, a new prize for fiction honors an Albanian writer. We'll hear from Ismail Kadare. You're listening to Here and Now. Did did you get the email? The one that said a prestigious medical institution had sent out a warning that microwaving food in plastic containers causes cancer. Well, it's a big fat lie. Here to parse fact from fiction when it comes to microwaving with plastic is health columnist Judy Foreman. Welcome, Judy.
Hi.
And there's a lot of medical institutions mentioned in this email that's flying around. You've spoken to them.
The whole thing is ridiculous. It's basically an urban legend. And this email keeps resurfacing and resurfacing and resurfacing. And it's just not true.
Well, the institutions say they're not involved with it at all. But what about the thinking that microwaving with plastic causes any kind of health problems?
Well, there's several pieces to this rumor. One is that if you microwave in plastic, you'll get dioxins in your food. That is completely not true. Dioxins are a human carcinogen, but we don't get them from microwaving food in plastic.
That's
we
right.
get them from eating animal fat, and that's because dioxins are made when you burn fuel and the combustion puts the stuff in the air and it trickles down to the plant leaves and the animals eat the plants and we eat the animals, and that's how you get dioxin. And we all have some in our bodies.
Okay, but you do not get it from microwaving plastic.
You do not get it from microwaving. There are no dioxins in plastic. And even if there were, they are not water-soluble, so they wouldn't get into the food or coffee that you're heating up. They would stay in the plastic.
Well, now the FDA has also weighed in on this, and they say there's nothing in plastic food containers that appears to be a concern. But aren't there different kinds of plastic food containers?
There are, and they're not always labeled, so it can be really hard for the normal consumer to figure out what's going on. At Tufts University in Boston, there's a woman who's been studying a different chemical that comes out from rigid clear plastics. It's called bisphenol A. And in animal studies, that can cause some disruption to the developing reproductive system. But in humans, there's no real data that there's any problem. The FDA has studied it and has found it to be safe, even in baby bottles.
Okay. What about plastic wrap?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. Again, you're probably fine if you don't wrap the food in the plastic wrap while you heat it, but if you just put that over the top of the container. The plastic wraps are made with another chemical called DEHA, which is a plasticizer, and that's the stuff that makes the cling wraps clingy and bendable. It's the stuff that makes you swear and curse in the kitchen when you're trying to wrap things. And this DEHA can leach out even without heating the plastic wrap. But again, if you do it without touching the food in the microwave, you're probably fine.
So, Judy Foreman, bottom line on microwaving.
You can certainly use glass or ceramic. That is going to be fine. And you can use plastics that say on the label or on the cardboard wrapping, safe for microwave use. Don't reuse like margarine tubs or the flimsy plastic that takeout food comes in.
Because they'll melt.
Because they can melt. And if you use plastic wrap in the microwave, try to have it not touch the food because it, again, can kind of melt onto the food. And if you really want to worry about something real, worry about getting the heat from the microwave throughout the whole food in the container so you don't have cold spots, which can harbor bacteria.
That's something real to worry about.
That is something real.
Here Now's Judy Foreman for her column on microwaving and plastic. Go to our website, here-now.org. And this quick note about two stories we've been following on Here and Now. Supporters of medical marijuana hope to blunt the impact of last week's Supreme Court ruling, which said that federal laws that outlaw marijuana trump state laws in 11 states, which do allow people to use the drug for medical purposes. Advocates say they plan to attach an amendment to a spending bill that the House is considering. That amendment would prohibit the Justice Department from using any money in its budget to prosecute doctors who prescribe marijuana or patients who use it. Also, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll look at the rising controversy over what's being called Memogate. Two memos from the British government indicate that the Bush administration was bent on war in Iraq despite the lack of intelligence, and the Bush administration was not adequately prepared for war's aftermath. That story tomorrow. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And later this month, Albanian poet and novelist Ismail Kadare will accept the first Man Booker International Prize for Fiction. This is the international version of the prestigious Man Booker Prize for Fiction given every year to British writers. Recently, Here and Now's arts critic Bill Marks had the pleasure to speak with Ismail Kadare, and he joins us to tell us more about this acclaimed writer. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
And before we get to Kadare, tell us about this new award, the Man Booker International Prize for Fiction. Why? Why did Booker decide to issue this?
Well, essentially, they began this award to widen the net of the amount of literary fiction or writing that they can reward. I mean, they've been, so far, the Man Booker has been simply British writers, and now they can deal with writing from around the world as long as it appears in English. So that includes American writers. For example, Saul Bellow was on the list before he died, and it also means writers in translation. So they can essentially encourage books in translation into English, and there's been a lot of concern about that lately, that there's not enough books being brought from around the world translated into English, and I think that's an attempt to try to, jumpstart that.
And the first recipient, Ismail Kadare, he beat out Günter Grass, Milan Kundera. Why did the Booker Committee choose him?
Well, he was a real long shot, by the way. Most of the literary community around the world was abuzz and stunned by the fact that Kadare won. The judges said, essentially, because he wrote wonderful fiction and poetry, that he was in a country which was very oppressed in terms of the arts and the freedom to write, that he wrote in a number of different genres, from fables to historical novels to sort of contemporary satires, and also by the authority that it conveyed in the sense that it managed to be critical of Albanian politics without being sort of overtly critical.
And tell us more about him. What do we know about him? Because I know you've spoken to him. We want to hear that. But who is he?
Well, he is he's sort of a writer's writer. He's now in his 70s. He is an interesting figure in the sense that he was an export writer to the extent that his work was not only recognized in Albania as he was writing, but also outside of its borders. And he was one of the few writers that was allowed to leave, which on the one hand has helped solidify his international reputation because he also lived in Paris or went to Paris on and off. So he managed to get his works translated. And at the same point, it's caused some controversy back home because he was a writer who was given that amount of freedom, to move outside of the country in a very repressed state.
Right. Well, as we said, you had a chance to speak to Ismail Kadare right after he was notified of the award. Tell us about that conversation.
Well, he was obviously delighted to receive this. I was interested in asking him a few questions, and also I don't speak Albanian. Kim Bachari, someone who works at WBUR, and you'll hear his voice is translating Kadare. So he was on the phone sort of asking questions that we worked out together. I wanted to know about what he thought was the value of this award. He's been shortlisted or on the shortlist for the Nobel Prize for Literature. But what ultimately is the value to the Balkans? And he felt that one significant value is that the Balkans are known in Europe and perhaps even, let's just say in the West, as being a place of aggression, place of sort of backwardness, the sort of a dark medieval place. And he hopes that this award will change that.
Literature alone cannot change perceptions, but it may initiate the creation of trust between other peoples, especially the cultural elites. Also, the Balkans need to be understood by Europe, because if the latter's biases become entrenched, they may play a negative role in the evolution of the region.
Bill Marks, did you ask him about how he's perceived in his home country, Albania, given some of the controversy you mentioned?
I sort of didn't want to be entirely direct, so I sort of asked him whether he considered himself a dissident writer, because the judges for the award specifically said he was a dissident writer, and he, in a sense, said that not in a classical sense.
In Albania, there was only one kind of genuine resistance, a silent resistance through literature and arts. This meant writing your books as if the regime did not exist, as if you were in a free world that was not influenced by the dogmas of socialist realism. Even a novel about love, written in a free way, was a kind of rebellion against the omnipresent propaganda.
So he sort of says that he was not an overtly dissident writer, where he could speak outwardly about political events, but he, in a sense, cloaked or disguised what he wanted to say about what was going on in this country and the censorship and the repressiveness by writing books in a way that had nothing to do with politics, but also in another funny way, in the sense that they often were fables or allegories. For example, a book I just read this weekend, which I hadn't read before, called The Pyramid, is about the building of a pyramid in Egypt. But of course, the building of the pyramid, the megalomania of the pharaoh, the death of all the workers who are creating this huge monument to the pharaoh was all about Albania.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the books. What are other books of Ismail Kadari that we should know about that are in print and translated into English?
Let me give you the ones that I think are the best or the ones that I like. I like The Palace of Dreams, which is sort of his most Kafkaesque parable about bureaucratic repression. The General of the Dead Army is an allegory and an interesting one about, you know, an army of corpses. Kadari is aware of the sense that the Balkans are considered to be a cursed place, a place of superstition, a place of, you know, sort of a mordant pessimism, and he often plays with that. And finally, The Concert, which is a more satiric look at the political allegiance at one point between communist China and Albania.
Okay, these are the books of Ismail Kadari, the first recipient of the first Man Booker International Prize for Fiction. I know you have an excerpt from one of his books that you want to share with us.
Yeah, let me just read this quickly. This is the most recent book that's been translated in English. It's called Spring Flowers, Spring Frost, and it deals with a sort of post-communist era in Albania. And it gives you an idea, sort of a sense of humor, and they're out, they're heading off to work, and they come across this sort of what looks like a sleeping snake in the road. And this brings about an entire crowd of people, all of whom sort of have to put in their 2 cents worth about people looking at a dead snake. A man in a felt hat seemed to be looking for a target for all his pent-up anger. "We've come to a pretty pass," he seemed to be saying. "Where but in Albania do you get minds as warped as that? No, we don't get up in the morning to do something useful. We get up with some crazy idea in our heads, unearthing sleeping snakes. What have you got between your ears, you little perverts? You wouldn't lift a finger to help save those antique vases or ancient bronzes people are forever digging up all over the place these days. Oh, no, you wouldn't. But you don't miss a beat when it comes to finding horrors like this."
Here now is arts critic Bill Marks speaking the words of Ismail Kadari. He is the first recipient of the first Man Booker International Prize for Fiction. And Bill, if you had been able to speak Albanian to him, you could have said, Gazua.
I really wish I could have.
Sort of a toast in Albanian. For more information on Albanian poet and novelist Ismail Kadari, go to our website, here-now.org. Bill, thanks.
Thanks, Robin.
And finally, this note. Yesterday, Michael Jackson was found not guilty on 10 counts of child molestation charges. The trial may be over, but the court of public opinion has begun. We leave you with the sounds of the jury, a fan, and late-night TV.
We expected probably better evidence, you know, something that was a little more convincing, and it just wasn't there.
What mother in her right mind would allow that to happen or just freely volunteer your child, you know, to sleep with someone? Not just so much Michael Jackson, but any person.
When I was younger, me and a lot of my little cousins would go over to his ranch, and he never did anything harmful to us but care and be open to us.
Good news for Michael Jackson, not guilty on all 10 counts.
Yeah.
The bad news, he's gone to Disneyland. Yeah.
Number one thing overheard during the Michael Jackson verdict, another case of a white guy getting preferential treatment. There you go.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.